Good morning. I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. Members, today we're going to have three bills before us. And before we get to that, we do need to approve the minutes from the last meeting. Representative Pinto, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 10th, 2023?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Pinto approves approval of the minutes for January 10th, 2023. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. All right, members, we do have three bills in our before us today. We've got House File 55, House File 42, and House File 111. Before we begin, I'd just like to say that these three bills have to do with victims and their family members. And it's really important in this committee that we talk about victims and survivors and think about the needs that they have. We hear hard testimony in this committee, things that are difficult to hear. But one of the things that I have found over the years that I'm really inspired by, both in my work at the legislature and as a prosecutor, is the strength that victim survivors have, especially when they're coming to committee to talk about situations that whatever legislation we pass may not bring their loved one back or may not help them in their cases, but they're trying to make things better for the people behind them. And I just want to remember that as we move forward and talk about bills this year. The other thing I'd like to mention is that when we talk about trust in our criminal justice system, it's so important for people to be able to trust the system, that the system is going to work for them no matter who they are. If they have someone who's missing, if they have a family member who's murdered, if they themselves are victims of crime, in order for there to be justice, there has to be trust in our criminal justice system. And I think that's really important today as we talk about the bills that are before us. And so with that, we will go ahead and we'll begin with House File 55. And welcome to the committee, Representative Richardson. Since you are not on the committee, I will move that House File 55 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. And Representative Richardson, I understand that you do have an A2 author's amendment. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, great. So there is the A2 amendment. And members, we will hear about the amendment. And I'll just remind folks, especially since we have a lot of new people on our committee, that it is custom and usage that we adopt author's amendments typically. That doesn't mean we won't discuss them. That is custom and usage here. Representative Richardson, would you like to go ahead and describe the A2 amendment, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 55, as amended with A2, would establish and maintain an Office of Missing and Murdered Black Women and Girls. As a state and a nation, we're facing an unacceptable crisis of missing and murdered black women and girls, and the data is simply horrific. When we started this legislative work in earnest in 2019, there were an estimated 64,000 to 75,000 missing black women and girls in the United States. What that significant range told us is that we don't even know the full scope of this crisis. In 2020, more than 100,000 black women and girls were reported missing. While black women account for less than 15% of the U.S. population, we make up more than one-third of all missing person cases in 2020. Black girls are less likely to receive Amber Alerts and more likely to be classified as runaways. They're also less likely to receive media attention and coverage. It's also important to note that missing person cases involving black women and girls stay open four times longer than their white peers. In addition, black women and girls are at increased risk of harm. More than 20% are raped in their lifetime. In Minnesota, where black women make up 7% of the population, we account for more than 40% of the reported domestic violence cases. And to be clear, that's reported cases. I would argue that figure is even higher when you take into account the cases that go unreported. Disparities also abound in human trafficking incidents. A two-year study of human trafficking found that 40% of sex trafficking victims were identified as black women. And what is very chilling is that convicted traffickers admittedly believe that trafficking black women would land them less jail time if caught than trafficking white women. In Minnesota, a black women are almost 3 times more likely to die of homicide. Across the U.S., at least 4 black women are murdered a day. This reflects, numbers are from 2021, and this reflects a 51% increase over 2019, the largest increase of any racial or gender group during that period. Furthermore, the number of unsolved homicide cases of black women rose 89% in 2020 and 2021 compared with 2018 and 2019. Again, a far bigger increase than any other demographic group during this period. This is a crisis, and it doesn't have to be this way. Behind these numbers are real people and real families devastated. We must do better, we can do better, and black women and girls deserve better. And the community agrees. This office has been vetted with community, with individuals with lived experience, grieving families, the faith community, organizations committed to the prevention of domestic violence and human trafficking, elected officials, law enforcement, medical examiners, county attorneys, county social service, youth programs, students, public health organizations, medical associations, education-related organizations, and a diverse group of nonprofits. We know we need to recognize and address the complexities that contribute to this crisis, including domestic violence, intimate partner violence, human trafficking, both labor and sexual exploitation, gang violence, the adultification and sexualization of black girls, disparities in our foster care system and out-of-home placements, homelessness, including those young adults who are homeless because they age out of the foster care system, systemic racism, poverty, mental health, substance use disorder, the role of media, the impacts of mistrust of law enforcement, and the disturbing trend of too many families feeling alone as they conduct their own investigations looking for answers. This bill would create an office that would go beyond tracking and analyzing the data and root causes of these disparities to include working with community to identify recommendations for strategies and solutions for prevention, supporting families on cold cases, providing grants to further the office's goals, and requiring the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to operate a missing person alert system, developing guidance to improve outcomes, and conducting much-needed public awareness campaigns. Today, Madam Speaker, I have several testifiers to me to share their support of the bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Richardson. And I don't know that I technically moved the A2 amendment. Is there anything specific you'd like to add about the A2 amendment?
Nothing specific. It really sort of encompasses what I talked about in terms of creating the grant program and also requiring the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to operate a missing alert person program.
Thank you. Members, any discussion to the A2 amendment before we get, I know there's an amendment to the amendment, but any discussion to the A2 amendment before we get to that? All right, I don't see discussion about that. So before we vote on the A2, we do need to move to the amendment to the amendment. I believe that's the A3. And who would be offering the A3 amendment?
That would be me, Chair Mullen.
Yeah. All right, do you want to go ahead, Representative Novotny, and explain the amendment to the amendment?
Thank you, Chair Mullen. It's a simple just addition of a couple sentences allowing the addition of police departments or government agencies to also be able to apply for grants for this specific training and enforcement techniques. It takes nothing away from the organizations that are already eligible for it, but thinking maybe there's some organizations that might want to work in connection with a government agency, maybe to get some training in. I think back to one of the last cases I worked as an investigator, tying into what Representative Richardson was saying, how black females are perceived in certain communities to be more vulnerable, or that their kidnapping or them going missing would be less likely to be investigated. And I can tell you that that was that was the perception of the perpetrator of that crime. Thankfully that those two girls were able to fight out and were not taken into the situation that he had planned for them. But I concur with her overall that that is a perception of the public. In dealing with the certain situations that these situations perceive, kind of tying into Representative Pinto's work in trafficking, it is something that agencies, if you're not working with it every day, you don't know. So if there is some way we can tie it into do this more of a prevention and working with organizations in a positive way to have that contact and establish these liaisons with law enforcement agencies, if someone has that desire, then I think that'd be an option that we should pursue.
To the amendment, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a point of clarification, I don't see that government agencies overall are listed within the amendment. And I do see that this would add law enforcement agencies to be eligible for the grant program that has been established in the bill for community-based organizations. And I would just say that the recommendation around the community grants was also vetted with law enforcement. They've been at the table through the work of the task force on this as well. And the bill also talks about ways that law enforcement would be coordinating with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and also with this office as well. And so I would recommend at this time a no vote, but happy to continue conversations to better understand what you're hoping to accomplish.
Thank you. Discussion to the amendment Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to remind folks, and thank you, Representative Damani, for referencing anti-trafficking work. This office would be housed within the Office of Justice Programs. Also in that office is the funding for the sex trafficking investigation teams that we established several years ago. And in fact, actually, the office is hiring for coordinator of those. So the point is, the director of this office would actually have as a colleague somebody who's directing and connecting with law enforcement. So in terms of your goal for that kind of coordination connection, I actually think housing it within OJP really does address that. So I would also go with the author of the bill in terms of opposing the amendment, though I really appreciate the sentiment of it, but I think we can achieve it through where the office is housed at OJP. Thank you.
Further discussion to the amendment, Representative Frazier.
Happens all the time. No worries. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to Representative Devaney, thank you for that, for raising that point, and Representative Richardson, thanks for bringing this bill. There is a House File 25 will be working its way through with some funding that I think will also address and speaking to law enforcement, have an ability to apply for grants to help with investigatory processes around prevention. So I think there will be some resources for that.
Further discussion to the amendment. Go back to the author of that, Representative Devaney.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. As I said, this doesn't lock the grant into being a law enforcement program. It just adds another option. I ask for your vote and I request a roll call.
A roll call has been requested, and there's no further discussion on the amendment to the amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Moeller?
No.
Vice Chair Feist?
No.
GOP Lee Devaney?
Yes.
Representative Becker Finn?
No.
Representative Curran?
No.
Representative Ingen?
Yes.
Representative Frazier?
No.
Representative Grussell?
Yes.
Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Tapke?
No.
And Representative Witte?
Yes.
There being six ayes and eight nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment to the amendment is not adopted. Moving on now to a discussion to the amendment. I think I left that open before the A2 amendment. I didn't see any discussion then, so we'll now take a vote on the A2 amendment. All those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and the A2 amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Richardson, you gave a great overview of your bill. Are you ready to move on to testifiers at this point?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, House File 55, as amended, is before us, and our first testifier today is Dr. Peter Hayden. Come on up. All right, if you can please state your name for the record and your title, and go ahead and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Sure. Welcome. My name is Dr. Peter Hayden. I'm the father of Jeffrey Hayden, a colleague of yours, former colleague of yours. And I'm also the father of Sydney Taylor, who's not with us anymore, Aaron Hayden, and my wife, Joyce Hayden. This morning, I thank you, Madam Chair and members, for giving me the opportunity to speak. Many of our colleagues behind me are women, and usually that's what happens, is because the mom is so important in the family. So I'm glad, Representative Richardson, you asked me to speak as a male in a family, a man who raised his children, who all went to Wayzata High School, who all went to HBCUs or Mississippi State, Missouri University, Prairie View A&M. We tried to do the right thing, my family. As I said, my son was a former colleague of yours. All my girls are graduates from college. I was in the house. All those stereotypes I don't bring with me. But where my support is from my sisters behind me is that it doesn't matter when someone has a gun, and that's how they define their spirituality, they define their masculinity. It doesn't matter. So I'm sitting here. Taylor goes to Prairie View A&M. She falls in love with a school in Texas, decides to move, come back home for a minute. And when she leaves, the next person I have knocking on my door are people who are there to serve and protect, telling me I need to call this number because, and I'm asking, what is the issue? And says, you are Taylor Hayden's dad. I said, yeah. And by then I knew I had lost my child. This house file must be passed. And I don't care how y'all decide to do it. It must be passed because we can't have more Taylor Haydens. And the people that are going to sit up here to talk with you, we can't have it. However way we work it, I want you to understand that was not just Taylor, not just the Hayden family, but all the families that's behind me, and some of you have suffered these type of incidents. So I definitely know you're sitting here because you care for the bill. However you work, way you work it out, do it right and do it on behalf of not just Taylor Hayden, but all the young men, I mean young women, who and moms who are suffering because of this incident. I know I had 3 minutes. I'm going to stay within my 3 minutes. I appreciate you. I run Turning Point. It's a chemical health, mental health program. I just celebrated my 50th year of sobriety. When you have someone taken from you like my daughter, I have some people say, if you get high, man, I can understand it. If you don't pass this bill, I won't understand it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Hayden, and our sympathies for your loss. We appreciate you being here today. And members, what we'll do is we'll have testimony from all the testifiers first before we open it up for questions. The next testifier is Lakeisha Lee. Come on forward. And then on deck, we'll have Dr. Verna Price after Lakeisha Lee. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead and begin with your testimony.
Thank you very much. My name is Lakeisha Lee. I am an advocate, and I very much appreciate all of you here today. I work with black women and girls all over the Twin Cities, but I also have had the unfortunate circumstances, just like Dr. Hayden. My sister was murdered in 2013. My sister is Brittany of Brittany's Place on the east side of St. Paul, right here in the Twin Cities. When my sister was killed, on the front page of every single newspaper in the city of St. Paul was her picture. And right underneath it, it said prostitute. Our family had to wake up to that with news at our door and media. My sister worked for the city of St. Paul, working with students in the North End neighborhood every day at Rec Check. My sister was an amazing caretaker. My sister was a part of the community. She was not a prostitute. She was a victim. Our black women and girls need this. Our community needs this, all of our communities. This is something that isn't going to change, no matter if my family is here testifying or a different family. The stories will be the same. We're still here doing the work, showing up and asking for the assistance and the help. This past year, I was able to chair the task force for the state working on a report for legislature to talk about the causes of this. I volunteered to re-traumatize myself willingly, and I do it all over again, just to be here today to let you guys know how important this is. We need a place to be able to access resources. Everyone needs a place to be able to figure this out, come together. We have to figure this out together. And this office will be able to assist with that. This is just the first step. We're all working together as a community. There's women behind me that have continued to support me through all the ups and downs that have continued to happen as I continue to stand up, show up, and fight for black women and girls, not even just here for Minnesota, but we're a blueprint for the nation. And thank you guys for being part of that. Thank you guys for allowing me to speak with you today.
Thanks also for your testimony and our sympathies for your loss. And thank you for being here for Brittany and all the other women and girls. We really appreciate it. All right, so Dr. Verna Price is next. And then on deck, we'll have Suwanna Kirkland. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Price. And you can go ahead and state your name and please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, committee. Thank you so much for having all of us here. This is a big deal for us. And I can tell you, his heart's just, even not just bawl, like weep, you know? Like in the Old Testament, they would just tear their clothes and weep. It was so hard. That's what we're talking about. And what we're asking for you is simply a structured collective response so that my mom, who calls me, oh, my name is Dr. Verna Price, Dr. Verna Cornelia Price, and I'm the author of a little purple book, and it's called The Power of People, Four Kinds of People Who Can Change Your Life. When North High called me in 2005, I just left the University of Minnesota as a professor there and written my first book. And my first book simply says there are four kinds of people in your life: adders, subtractors, multipliers, and dividers. And learn how to be an adder, stay away from subtractors, run from dividers, and hope you have a multiplier. North High School called me and said, Dr. Verna, would you please come and simply be a positive role model to our girls? That was the call. It was a community call. Today, the community is calling you all. They're calling you to make a decision. And I said yes to my community. I didn't know what I was getting into. That yes ended up with me creating a program called Girls Taking Action. It used to be Girls in Action. And you all have supported that program at a state level. I'm very thankful for that. We have many of our girls taking action, women leaders behind me. We've impacted over 5,000 girls in Minnesota. And those girls have learned how to be adders and how to spot subtractors. When my mom called me and said, my daughter is missing, Dr. Verna, she had nowhere to go. And the police was not answering her call. But because we had a wraparound, what I would say, response to our girls, those lead mentors back there, they have a phone number for the mamas. They have a phone number for the girls. They know who the girls are talking to. They know who the new boyfriend is or not. They know, and now we have social media in the mix, right? They're checking with the girls to see who are you talking to at 2 o'clock in the morning in some little social media chat room, right? So we actually were able to reach for that girl because we knew her. As a collective community response, we knew her. And that's really what it's going to take for this thing, for us to really make sure that we're protecting our black girls. That's what I'm asking you. This is what this office does. It says to our black girls who, unfortunately, since slavery times, since black women were bought here on slave ships, they have been seen as expendable. And we are not. We matter. And I want the state to show that we matter. Give us an office. Give us the resources we need so that my mom, when she calls me, I can say, oh, no, I got a place for you to go. Call such and such and such and such. I didn't have that. So we just ended up tracking the girl. I ended up in Walmart in the middle of the night, you know, with her going to Walmart and sneaking away and running to my car and really putting my own self in danger to get her safely back home. But this office gives us a structured, strategic response to this so that community organizations like ourselves, when this happens, we have a place to go, we have someone to call, and we have what's called legitimacy and credibility behind us. Because sometimes the officers don't believe us, right? And as a result, we just don't get the support. So what am I asking you to do, committee? I'm asking you to support this office. Get us an office. Let's get this work done for our girls. Let's show our black girls and women that they matter in this state. Thank you so much for listening to me and continuing to do your good work. Thank you, Representative Richardson, for asking me to come.
Thank you for your testimony and for the important work you do. We appreciate that you're here today. Next, we have Sawana Kirkland, and then on deck we'll have Artika Roller. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kirkland. If you can state your name and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Molnar, and members of the Public Safety Committee. My name is Sawana Kirkland. I am currently the National Vice Chair for the National Black Police Association, as well as the past president for the Minnesota chapter. I am also the Director for Dakota County Community Corrections. I want to read the letter that the National Black Police Association wrote in support of this office, and then I'll have a very brief remarks myself. Dear Chairman and members of the Public Safety Committee, the National Black Police Association Minnesota chapter is writing regarding House File 55 to support the development of a missing and murdered black women and girls office. NBPA Minnesota is a nonprofit law enforcement affinity association representing several agencies, cities, counties throughout the state of Minnesota. It is our goal to increase representation and visibility of black law enforcement in the community through service and relationship-based policing. NBPA Minnesota would not be successful without the support of the communities we all serve. Nationally, there are estimates that between 64,000 and 75,000 black women and girls are missing. Data shows that black women are twice as likely to be victims of homicide. As well as the data also shows that cases involving missing and black women and girls stay open 4 times longer than others. There's a crisis, and this office is important, is an important step forward to work to prevent incidents of violence, ensure more resources for cold cases, improve public safety. We respectfully ask members to support House File 55. Thank you for considering our letter of support. Respectfully, Officer Brad Chin, who is the president of the National Black Police Officer Association Minnesota chapter. I've been in law enforcement for 19 years as an officer and as a leader. I have seen an increase in incidents of violence within our communities of for black women and girls, and a decrease in resources and services and dedicated efforts and supports to help solve these crimes. I have seen that. I am the mother of 2 black amazing young women. I would hate to get that knock at the door that many of our community members, our mothers and our fathers, have received regarding their children. I would hate to see my sister or my aunt or a family member in the media, front page, missing. This is vital. This is crucial. Our women, our community, we need an office, a place to go where there are resources, adequate resources and support for our women and girls. It must happen, and it must happen now. Throughout my work, I go across this country and I talk about the great work that Minnesota has done, the great work that we are charged with. This is a model that can be replicated and implemented across this country. Minnesota must lead in this space. It must lead now. This is our opportunity, and this is our time. My sisters and brothers behind me, I mean, and there are thousands that have stories just like ours. Law enforcement, the National Black Police Association, is committed. This is, I believe, my 3rd time testifying, and I'll come back again, 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 and again, as long as we need to get this across. It's imperative. It's critical, and it must happen. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony and the important work you do. And also a reminder that the packet is full of letters of support. So members, please make sure to read all the letters that have come in support of this important bill. Thank you. And then next we have Artika Roller. Welcome to the committee. If you can introduce yourself and tell us where you work and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Mueller and committee members and Representative Richardson. My name is Artika Roller. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, also known as MNCASA. MNCASA is a statewide coalition representing more than 60 programs across the state of Minnesota, providing technical assistance, support, and training to those programs that are doing wonderful work with our victims and survivors. They are our frontline advocates. In my 20-year career, I have been devoted to addressing sex trafficking, domestic violence, sexual assault, and centering the needs of victims and survivors. During my career, I have had the opportunity to see the best of people, and unfortunately, I have also had the opportunity to see the worst of people. I have provided services, and unfortunately, I have lost many of the women and girls that we have worked with to violence and to murder, and my task was to support their families after that horrible incident occurred. The findings of the MMAAW report confirms the harsh truth, one that African-American communities in Minnesota have known for a long time. Violence against black women and girls in our state is in an undeniable crisis that needs to be addressed. This epidemic is the product of over 400 years of targeted violence, erasure, and crimes against black women and girls, and including systematic barriers to justice. The report revealed that black women and girls in Minnesota are far more likely to experience violence than their peers. Yet when they turn to our systems to that claim to offer support and promote justice, they are often disbelieved, stereotyped, and subjected to additional trauma. This is unacceptable. We have the power to disrupt violence against African American women and girls by establishing and funding a standalone office for the murdered and missing African American women that would also partner with our murdered and missing indigenous relative office, but would be two separate offices to support the distinct needs of both of our communities. This office will improve outcomes, provide support for black women and girls in Minnesota and their family. Today, we have the opportunity to do more than just simply acknowledge that there is a crisis, but we have an opportunity to do something. The other thing that we're asking you to do in this process is that we can listen and should listen and also take heed to the wisdom of black women and girls. They are the ones that actually worked on this report, and we would like to, again, not only listen, but take heed to their wisdom and knowledge. The justice and safety and healing for African American women and girls is long overdue, and we urge you to vote yes for House File 55. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you for your testimony and also for the important work that you do. I'm sure we'll be seeing you again throughout the session.
Yes.
Thank you. And we do have one member of the public who signed up to testify. That's Gloria Perez. So please come to the table. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself, state your title, and you can begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. My name is Gloria Perez. I'm the president and CEO of the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 55. For 40 years, the Women's Foundation has invested more than $45 million in organizations across the state, hearing from our communities the realities that women and girls face and advancing policies that advocate for them. We have long funded work in Minnesota to make it a safer place for women and girls and have supported the passage of important bills such as Minnesota's Safe Harbor Law, the Office of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives, and the Missing and Murdered Black Women's Task Force. Our research with the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School, published last year, shows that gender-based violence from sex trafficking to domestic abuse remains a significant problem in Minnesota. The impact is disproportionately on black and indigenous women and women of color. Nationally, black women have the highest rates of death due to homicide, followed by Native American women. In Minnesota, black women are murdered at a rate of 2.7 times higher than white women. To find solutions that change systems so that more black women and girls can be safe and well, we need to listen to the lived experience of women. When we center their experiences and solutions, we can serve the families experiencing the greatest harms. As a result of the leadership of the Missing and Murdered African American Women's Task Force and the work of researchers, community members, Department of Public Safety staff, and legislators, we know more about this epidemic in Minnesota than ever before. The report issued by the task force provides thorough research and, importantly, stories of family members, survivors, and communities who have been impacted directly by the violent death of a loved one or who are still searching for vindication. The report's recommendations are grounded in their voices and experiences. It could not be more important for Minnesota to take this step and establish an office to support families coordinate investigations, identify connections between trafficking and other crimes, and ultimately change the systems that prevent the violence so that black women and girls can thrive in Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Richardson for her vision and persistent leadership on this issue. The Women's Foundation urges the legislature to move quickly to establish this office. There is no time to waste in making Minnesota a place that honors and respects the safety and whole lives of black women and girls. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify? Welcome. Please come on up, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your testimony.
My name is Devon Muhammad. I work for Turning Point, Inc. in North Minneapolis. And I have a sister who's a survivor of violence, and I came with Dr. Peter Hayden. I wasn't here to testify or nothing, but when I heard the bill, I just was compounded to just say something. And so I had a sister who was almost murdered in 1981 by Paul Stefani. And this guy was released out of prison. He was released. The FBI knew that they were looking for him, right? And they lost contact of him when he had caught up with my sister and almost killed her. Now, my sister, the reason I wanted to speak because my sister has never recovered from that. And she still has. The reason I'm saying that is because when, there wasn't no resources for her. You know, she had treatment, didn't work, just didn't have the resources at the time, right? And so every time, so she called me one night, like about 3 months ago, called me. That's another reason I wanted to say something, because she's still traumatized by this guy, right? After over 30 years, almost 40 years. And so what came on the TV was this documentary saying, well, he runs into another former victim after he killed 3 or 4 Native women, right? He runs into another type of victim, which insinuated that my sister was a street person, that she was a killer also, you know. And so she's always, every time she hears this thing can pop up on the TV at any time, and she'll call me crying. I just heard his voice. And so I wanted to share that it's important that law enforcement, you know, stick to their guns when they're looking for people, for especially with women of color, because we are underserved, right? And so I just think that this bill should get passed, and I wanted to share my opinion. And I hope I'm okay with my boss back here. And thank you very much. Again, my name is Divine Muhammad. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Muhammad.
Madam Chairman, thank you.
Yes, your boss is smiling and nodding, so I think you're good. But we really do appreciate you being here, and what a great brother you are to your sister for being here on her behalf. So thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no other testifiers, we are going to go ahead and move to member discussion of the bill. Anybody, any comments from members? All right. Oh, Representative Beckerfitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I am happy to be a co-author of this bill. And I did want to encourage members, if they haven't looked at the report where this recommendation came from, that you go and actually look at that report. It's really well put together. And the thing about the report that really struck out to me is, you know, ideally we prevent these bad things from happening to people in the first place, and the connection to providing both temporary and long-term safe housing for people and how that all ties together. You know, it's really easy for folks to agree, like, yes, we need to prevent these things from happening, but then sometimes connecting the dots with actually funding all those pieces that add up to preventing those things is harder for folks. And so I just wanted to make that connection and also just encourage the public and other members of the committee to go actually look at that report and read through all of the recommendations, not just the recommendation that we start this office. But thank you, Chair Richardson, for being a champion for this issue. It's I know it means a lot to our community as a Native person that the MMIWR office was established, and it has made a difference for folks now. And so I think it's really important that we continue that work and extend those good things to other parts of the community that need us to lift them up. So thank you.
All right, closing comments, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for
Oh, I'm sorry. Was there somebody else over here that wanted to speak? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I ask a question of Representative Richardson?
You may.
I have a question about the scope of the office. So obviously we've been focusing on black women, black girls. There's also, I'm sure you would agree, issues with black men, black boys. There was recently a Star Tribune article that discussed the 135 homicides that occurred in Minneapolis and St. Paul during the year 2021. And if you look at the breakdown of those cases, 76% of them were male. I'm sure there's a reason for the specific focus of this office, but I'd like to know what that reason is.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson, for the question. What we know right now in terms of the rising rates of this crisis, we are seeing that murder rates are increasing faster among black women when compared to other races and other genders. We also understand that cold cases are increasing as well. I understand that as we look at this issue and the complexities of it around gender, there are also an abundant amount of needs that need to be addressed for black men and black boys, and happy to work with you on a bill that could really look at addressing that crisis as well. So thank you for your interest and support of that.
Any follow-up?
No, thank you.
Any further discussion? All right, Representative Richardson, closing comments. Not giving people enough. It's different in a Zoom room when everybody, the hands just pop up. You have to have a different skill set here. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Richardson, thank you for bringing this bill. I think that it came through last time. We passed it off the floor before, but thank you for bringing it back, and I'm hoping we can get this done quickly. As the father of three daughters, this is something that is, it hits close to home for me. And I also have a ton of aunts growing up that are still back in Illinois, back in Chicago. And for me, I've had conversations with them about how in many occasions they feel unsafe in certain situations, particularly at night when they're traveling home from work. And part of the fear is that if something would happen to them, that there wouldn't be a priority on ensuring that whatever happened would be resolved, or that someone would be held accountable. And I talk a lot about prevention and intervention, and this office is geared directly toward that. Many of the bills I carried have been about putting resources to those efforts, which I think when we talk about any uptick in crimes or any unsafe communities, we often focus on one tool. There are alternatives. There are multiple tools that we can use to prevent these things from happening. So I'm glad you brought this bill. I'm looking forward to voting yes on this. I am a proud co-author of it, so I'm looking forward to supporting it. And Representative, thank you for bringing up the issue about the other issues that are happening in terms of the crimes that are happening in communities at a disproportionate rate for black men. And I'm glad you brought that up because I will look forward to you for working on solutions to that as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the author, the amended version of the bill requires the BCA to operate a missing persons alert program and places additional crime alert network requirements on the BCA. And so I'm looking at the fiscal note, and I'm wondering, have you requested an updated fiscal note with the new responsibilities that are going to be placed on the BCA?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Grassl. I worked very closely with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the Office of Justice Program on the amendment. The Minnesota Crime Alert Network is a system that is already established and in play, and it's already being used for missing persons alerts, and there are requirements that are already in state statute that we're building on, including around Brandon's Law. So the infrastructure is already in place.
Any follow-up, Representative Russell? Okay, one last pause here. I'm looking around. All right. I think now, Representative Richardson, we can have your closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion as well. Madam Chair, I appreciate you recognizing the urgency of this issue and hearing this this bill early in session and prioritizing this hearing, because since we started work here at the Capitol back in 2019 around this issue, the crisis has only deepened and it's worsened. And I also just want to lift up the reality that because this is not the first time that we are sitting before a committee asking for an office, what it takes for the folks sitting behind me who have experienced significant trauma to return time and time again to relive that trauma. It's not okay. And they deserve better, and our communities deserve better. Everyone deserves equal access to justice, and everyone deserves that to have the answers and accountability. A dedicated response is long overdue, and I ask that members support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. I will renew my motion that House File 55, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks again to all our testifiers today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, the next bill is Chair Feist's bill, House File 42. We will give her a minute to get up to the testifier table. And members, so you'd know that the motion before us is to be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Representative Feist, sorry, we need you to,
sorry, I'm too chatty.
No, no worries. Representative Feist, would you like to move that House File 42 be recommended to be placed on the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right, fantastic. And I believe, Representative Feist, that you also have an amendment, the A1 amendment. And would you like to move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape you desire?
Yes, I do.
All right, would you like to briefly tell us what the A1 amendment does?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment simply makes it explicit that the terminology used in the sex trafficking context is the same as the definitions in the labor trafficking. And this was a recommendation from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission that we heard from, and we are able to act on that recommendation very quickly by adding it to this bill.
All right, thank you. That is very quick work since we just heard that presentation, and appreciate that you were able to make that happen. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? All right, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Feist, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was developed in collaboration between the Hennepin County Attorney's Office and the Advocates for Human Rights, as well as labor trafficking experts. The goal with these changes is to address some glaring holes in our existing statutes that enable perpetrators to evade the law. This bill also enhances penalty in labor trafficking scenarios where the victim is under the age of 18, the trafficking occurs for an extended period of time, or the victim suffers great bodily harm or death. My testifier, Susan Crum, is a retired senior assistant Hennepin County attorney in the Complex Crimes Unit, and she'll provide more technical explanation and the specific scenarios that this bill seeks to address. In addition, Madeline Lohman from the Advocates for Human Rights and Superintendent Drew Evans from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension will be here to testify in support of this bill as well. And we're running late, so we'll be real efficient in our testimony. Thank you.
All right, great. Is Susan Crum going to testify first? All right, come on up. Ms. Crum, and welcome to the committee. I used to share an office floor with Ms. Crum, so it's nice to see you over here today. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin your testimony.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Chair Moeller and Vice Chair Feist. Good morning, committee members. As the chair has stated, I am a retired senior assistant Hennepin County attorney, but I am here on behalf of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. And the new county attorney, Mary Moriarty, does fully support this bill, so I did want to share that. Our proposal for amending the criminal statute comes out of our experience prosecuting a labor trafficking case in 2018 in Hennepin County. And I want to point out that the acts that occurred in this were not limited to Hennepin County. They were all over the metropolitan area and affected many people within the metropolitan area. At that point, few labor trafficking cases had actually been charged and prosecuted. There were a few other cases, but they were all arose out of sex trafficking matters and were sort of an alternative charging theory. When we looked at the facts of our case and the language of the statute, we realized that capturing this criminal conduct, describing the control and the exploitation of the victims and holding perpetrators accountable was really going to be challenging. In this case, we prosecuted a labor trafficker by the name of Ricardo Batras. He employed largely undocumented workers in the construction industry. They were doing sheetrock, framing, and the like. He had no workers' compensation insurance. He lacked safety equipment necessary for employees who were working at height, did not pay standard wages, and certainly had no benefits, no payroll taxes, etc. Needless to say, multiple workers were injured, and when they wanted to seek medical care, he refused that. Eventually, the victim in our case was severely injured on a job site when a wall fell on him and literally broke his back. The other workers were very concerned about his safety, took him to HCMC, and then, of course, he was not allowed by Mr. Batras to report that that was a job-related injury. So charity care or public funds had to be accessed to pay for his injury and treatment. Based upon these facts, I mean, we looked at this case and went, we have to use the tools that we have with the labor trafficking statute. And based upon that experience, we are making recommendations to amend the statute to make the language clearer and hold people who commit this type of act accountable. We do have some proposals here that clarify some of the definitions. One of them is debt bondage. And if you look at the debt bondage language, it's clearly couched in terms that are contractual and seem to imply that victims in labor trafficking willingly and voluntarily enter into a debt bondage agreement. And that's just not the reality of the situations. Here, the victim in the case was at some point arrested and thrown into ICE custody. The defendant bailed him out and said, I hired you a lawyer. You owe me money. You need to work this off. There was no discussion. There was no agreement, and in fact, there was no lawyer that ever showed up for the victim in this case. So that language, amending the debt bondage statute, our goal here is to clarify that and make it not sound like a contract exists when it does not. We are also recommending to that the statute be amended to actually represent or recognize the threats of harm and the types of harm that are actually used by traffickers. There could be threats of physical restraint, sexual contact, psychological, economic, or reputational harm, or the commission of certain acts. And I think there are certainly cases where we have people who are, they could be restrained, they could be beaten, they could be forced to work. But that's not the reality of most of these situations. And when you look at somebody who is told repeatedly, I know you're undocumented, no more powerful control could be exerted on a victim than to know that their trafficker holds that information over them. In fact, in the Batras case, he claimed he was a volunteer at ICE. He had connections, and he could help people. He reminded them frequently that he basically held their freedom within his hands. He also, when the victim was hospitalized, told him, you can't tell anyone that you were hurt on the job, because if you do, they'll deport you. They will not care how badly you're injured. They won't care that your back has literally been broken. So that was our experience with this case, and that's why we're recommending these amendments. We're also recommending that there be an amendment to the sentencing structure of the statute. As it presently exists, there are only two types of sentencing that are recognized. when the victim is a minor. The maximum sentence is 20 years. If the victim is an adult, the maximum sentence is 15 years. We are recommending that that sentencing structure reflect the different levels of harm that a victim could incur within the trafficking situation, and also that it parallel other criminal statutes that recognize different levels of harm. One of the subdivisions would be trafficking resulting in death. The second subdivision would be instances where the victim suffers great bodily harm, where the victim is under 18, or where the trafficking occurs over the extended over an extended period of time. And then the last instance, we would be recommending that the law continue to contain sort of a catch-all labor trafficking. And those relative penalties would be maximum 25 years, 20 years, or 15 years, which is would be the catch-all. And, you know, should this recommendation be approved, this would necessitate, of course, that the Guidelines Commission rank these offenses, and we would recommend that.
Thank you so much, Ms. Crum. We appreciate your testimony. And next up, we have Ms. Madeline Lohman. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, state your title, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Moeller, and Vice Chair Feist, and members of the committee. My name is Madeline Lohman. I'm an Associate Program Director with the Advocates for Human Rights, and we are very pleased to testify in support of this bill today. I'm going to provide some context around the importance of this issue. So the Advocates has done extensive work on labor trafficking in Minnesota. We both provide legal assistance to victims of trafficking, and we do research, training, and protocol development on labor trafficking as well as sex trafficking. For people who aren't familiar with the entirety of labor trafficking, the heart of the issue is that an individual uses control, coercion, or manipulation to get some kind of labor or services from their victim, and the victim believes they're unable to leave or stop. They're essentially trapped in the situation because of the actions of the trafficker. The goal of this bill is to bring clarity to exactly what those actions are to ensure that we are really protecting the full range of victims. This is something that happens throughout the state of Minnesota. We interview people as part of our research, and we serve clients from all over throughout the metro area, but also all parts of greater Minnesota. We've had cases of agricultural workers on temporary visas where the trafficker threatened to withhold their visa and force them to pay kickbacks. We've had cases where family members or people in a romantic relationship are requiring their family member to work and turn over all the money from their job while facing serious abuse in their home. We've also had cases where U.S. citizen youth joined magazine sales crews to go door to door, see the country, earn a good sales commission, and they end up trapped in those situations. In one story that I was told, a young lady had to crawl out of the hotel bathroom window where she was staying in Chicago because the company put representatives in all the hotel rooms to ensure that their workers could not leave. This is something that impacts all of us. Our victims can come from any community, and I think as Susan Crum's testimony showed, it also has costs for all of us in the community. We've seen in the biannual human trafficking report put out by the Department of Public Safety that in 2017, service providers identified nearly 400 victims in the state of Minnesota. We think that even though that is a high number, it is a significant undercount. There is almost no government agency or non-governmental organization that routinely screens for labor trafficking. So these are cases that are uncovered inadvertently in the course of people's other work. I can imagine that if there was regular screening, we would see substantially higher numbers. Despite the fact that service providers have seen almost 400 victims of trafficking in 2017, since the labor trafficking law was passed in 2005, there have been 3 cases charged under state law that were pure labor trafficking cases, and only one of them, the case that Ms. Crum mentioned, resulted in a conviction. This is a sign that our law is seriously failing at protecting victims of labor trafficking. I think Susan Crum highlighted some of the confusing language, but this is not just about bringing clarity to the law. This is also about bringing us into conformity with other states. We were one of the first states to pass human trafficking legislation in 2005, so we did not have many models to draw from. We now have human trafficking legislation in every state in this country, and we can look to it to ensure that we are providing the widest range of protections. So one of the things that Susan mentioned is being explicit that trafficking victims can face not just bodily harm, but also psychological, economic, or reputational harm. This is a provision and the language that is used by 26 other states, including Alabama, Montana, Oklahoma, and New York. We have also introduced new levels of seriousness for sentencing that reflect the harm experienced by victims. There are a number of other states, including Hawaii, Kentucky, Missouri, and Tennessee, that also enhance penalties when victims suffer serious harm. I also want to point out and urge members of the committee to take seriously possible unintended consequences. Increased enforcement and prosecution of crimes can fall unequally on people of color and immigrants. That is a concern of ours. So increasing criminalization of a behavior without knowing whether it will have a racially disparate impact is a concern. But we are driven to support this bill nonetheless, because the populations most at risk of labor trafficking are immigrants, people of color, people living in poverty, youth, people with criminal records, people with developmental disabilities, and other highly vulnerable populations that need our protection. We just heard extremely powerful testimony about black women and girls that are not receiving the protection they need, and that kind of harm is what makes this bill so important to address. But I want to urge robust monitoring and oversight to make sure the law does not increase racial disparities in criminal justice. So thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. I look forward to working with you on this bill.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And I noticed you had the letter, the Advocates has a letter of support in the packet, and there are other letters of support in the packets as well.
Yes,
this is available online for people watching. Thank you. Superintendent Evans is our last testifier on the list. If you could please introduce yourself, Superintendent, and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you. And members of the committee, my name is Drew Evans. I'm the Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I want to thank Vice Chair Feist for bringing this bill forward. This past summer, a labor trafficking protocol was released that was developed in partnership with the Minnesota Department of Health, Advocates for Human Rights, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. That was a conglomeration of a number of multidisciplinary members that came together to build this protocol. This is an outgrowth of some of that work and recognition, as Attorney Crum noted today, that there was creating a simplification and plain language in the law that we certainly have seen as we do our work at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I just want to get in front of you today, members, to note that the BCA fully supports this language. We think it's a very good bill that will simplify the laws, as we noted, under this, and as the BCA leads the Minnesota Human Trafficking Investigators Task Force, which primarily focuses on sex trafficking that's been noted here today. But there's a recognition of both our team that has several cases under way related to labor trafficking, that there needs to be an increased focus in Minnesota on this type of crime, because it really does impact all of our communities across Minnesota. And this bill is a really good step forward in terms of simplifying the laws and providing prosecutors the tools they need as we present cases to them to charge these cases and hold individuals accountable who create this harm. Lastly, I should just note, because the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is within the Department of Public Safety, I'm here supporting the technical changes to the language, not the sentencing piece, as we generally don't take a position on sentencing matters.
Thank you so much, Superintendent. Anybody from the public wish to testify? All right, seeing none, let's go ahead to member questions. First up is Representative Becker Fenn. No? Oh, okay. We're going to get this right here, actually. Anybody? Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Feist, you removed the lines 116 and 211. Remove the statutes for a definition of the word blackmail. Why are we doing that?
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. I meant to mention this up front because I knew somebody would ask. We are not removing blackmail. We're just redefining it as reputational harm, which is the more updated language that's being used. So it still is very much part of the definition of labor trafficking. It's just being used in a different way on line 3.5, where we talk about bodily, psychological, economic, or reputational harm, which is blackmail.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller.
Any other questions? Closing comments, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just encourage everyone to support this important bill. It's going to protect more victims in Minnesota in a really thoughtful way that will conform will have some federal conformity and also some more clarity in the aggravated sex trafficking context as well. Thank you.
Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 42, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
We'll see you on the floor. Members, we're just going to change spots here. Yes, this is my first time doing this. Let's see how it goes. Our last bill up today is HF 111, related to surreptitious intrusion. Chair Mueller, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, my motion, Madam Chair, is that the bill be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we have your bill before us. There are no amendments filed on your bill, so please tell us about your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So House File 111 is a combination of two bills that we heard last year. The first part of the bill really wasn't a separate bill because it was in relation to a Supreme Court case called the McReynolds case that came out in the spring of last year. And so it was too late to introduce a bill, but we did address the gaps that were left open by that Supreme Court case with an amendment on the House floor to our omnibus bill last year. And then it moved over to conference committee, and we were able to work with our nonpartisan staff and nonpartisan staff in the other body on this language. And I believe it would have been, if we would have had a bill last year, I believe that this language would have been included. The second part of the bill was a standalone bill, and it had to do with the statute of limitations and increasing the statute of limitations so that victims of these crimes of surreptitious intrusion can actually get justice when they find out about these crimes that have been committed against them. That was a Representative Miller bill, and he is here in the audience today and happy to carry the torch for that bill because it was a very good bill. And so that's basically what this is. It's a combination of those two things. Just to talk for a minute about the McReynolds case for the first part of the bill. In McReynolds, there was a situation where Mr. McReynolds admitted that he had gone on a date with a woman. They ended up in her apartment, naked in bed. He said that during the night he took cell phone video of her without her consent while she was in bed. I mean, he knew that he had done this without her consent and that he intended to interfere with her privacy when he had done so. She had discovered that he had done this, and she reported it. Mr. McReynolds ultimately pled guilty. Eventually, he ended up challenging that guilty plea, moved to withdraw the plea, based on the language of the statute here, the surreptitious intrusion statute. And the issue is because the way our language is currently written in statute, you can only be guilty of surreptitious intrusion if you install or use a device for recording through a window or any other aperture of a house, of a place of dwelling. So clearly the statute was written at a time when these cell phone devices didn't exist and could so easily record things. So ultimately this case went up to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and they said that, unfortunately, with this language that just his act of recording her because it wasn't through a window or a door essentially meant that he couldn't be guilty of this crime. And the Supreme Court acknowledged that this really created a very strange situation, an absurd situation. They actually gave us some suggestions from other states. You know, they said it's not up to us to change the statute. That's the legislature's function. They referenced some other state laws that had more modern language to really account for these situations. So unfortunately, Mr. McReynolds' case was reversed because of this. And so we want to make sure that this doesn't happen in other situations and that victims in these cases get justice. So the bill fixes that problem in, let's see, lines, beginning with line 4.21. That addresses the McReynolds issue, and then our nonpartisan staff, being as excellent as they are, discovered another gap in the law, and that is addressed beginning on lines. It's F. So beginning on lines 4.30, and that's sort of an upskirt recording situation. They discovered that there was another situation where we were not really addressing situations that could occur that we would want to find that conduct unlawful. And then if you look to the last page of the bill, that's where the statute of limitations language comes in. That's the Representative Miller's bill beginning on line 10.3. And Madam Chair, I do have a testifier here today that's going to describe why it's necessary to change the statute of limitations.
Madam Chair, would your testifier like to come? And as a reminder, please state your name and your title for the record, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Madeline Pung. I am currently a law student, and I am before you today to share my story and shed light on the importance of amending the current interference with privacy language under Minnesota Statute 609.746, as well as the statute of limitations for such crimes under Minnesota Statute 628.26 as proposed in Bill House File 111. Unbeknownst to me, my personal story of victimization and exploitation occurred on April 22, 2018. On that date, nearly 5 years ago, I accepted an offer from a childhood friend to tour his pig farm in Olivia, Minnesota. I viewed this as a novelty experience. I was told I would have to shower because of biohazard requirements. You see, hog barns are biohazard controlled, meaning by law one must shower in and shower out to prevent the contamination and spread of illness. I did as told and continued with the tour, never having thought about it again until May 3rd, 2021. This was the date that my sense of security was ripped away from me, and betrayal, the definition of betrayal, took a new meaning. On this day, an article published by the West Central Tribune was sent to me. The link was titled, "Olivia Mann Alleged to Have Filmed Women in the Shower at His Hog Barn." I read the article multiple times, just having to read it again and again to make sure I was understanding it correctly. 23 videos and 104 still images were taken, surreptitiously taken, of naked women showering at his hog farm without their knowledge or consent between October 30th, 2016 and December 12th, 2019. I felt physically ill and emotionally traumatized because at that moment I knew that I was the victim of a sexually motivated crime. I had no idea of the emotional roller coaster path that lay before me, nor did I understand the gravity it would have on my mental health, gravity and impact it would have on my mental health. I would become known as victim number 11 out of 17 women to the Renville County Sheriff's Office. After connecting with the lead investigator on the case and confirming my identity in one of the videos, I learned that the predator used the same method of operation in committing every one of his crimes. He waited until each of his victims were showering off, wherein he simultaneously snuck outside, climbed up a ladder, watched and filmed me and 16 other women naked through an egress-style window. What further compounded this traumatization was what I learned next. My case would not be included in the charges brought against my perpetrator under Minnesota Statute 609.746 because of the 3-year statute of limitations for interference with privacy, which had expired just 8 calendar days before discovering that I was a victim in this predatory scheme. Only 6 out of the 17 victims in this case were protected and considered chargeable offenses, while 11 women have been left to deal with the ongoing consequences of this predator's actions and without their day in court, all due to the inadequate statute of limitations for interference with privacy. While a life wasn't lost, something intangible yet invaluable had been. My sense of security and trust have been irreparably shattered, and my grief is further amplified by the fact that receiving justice for my case and those that occurred before mine is impossible. Holding my perpetrator accountable in criminal court for the crimes he committed against me and others is not an option, an opportunity the law is supposed to afford us. It has forced me to rethink about what justice looks like and compelled me to pay attention to where the law falls short. There are major flaws in the law we are reexamining today, and I want to be very explicit. The statute of limitations for interference with privacy expires before many victims even know they are victims of a crime, thereby perpetuating re-victimization. It is egregious that a criminal may not be held accountable for the crimes they commit because they were able to go undetected just long enough for the statute of limitations to run out, while the trauma victims experience has no expiration date. It is imperative that we make the proposed amendments to Bill House File 111 to be more inclusive with consideration to technological advancements and reflect a more equitable and reasonable window for victims to seek justice. The victims of invasion of privacy crimes deserve a voice beyond the current statute of limitations 3-year limit and should not unknowingly lose the opportunity to be heard, all because law enforcement had yet to discover the crime's existence. I implore you to approve the revisions proposed today that allow indictments to be found or made and filed within 3 years after the commission of the offense or 3 years after the offense was reported to law enforcement authorities. It is worthy of your consideration and vote. This amendment will have a positive impact on countless victims and negate the emotional distress that occurs when victims perceive the door has been closed on them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mueller, and thank you, Ms. Hung, for being here. We're so sorry about what happened, and we thank you for your bravery and your advocacy being with us today.
Thank you.
Before we move on to member questions and discussion, do we have anyone else from the public who would like to testify on HF 111? And just to be clear, too, we have about 6 minutes left before we need to take a vote.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, my name is Tim Miller, and I guess I'm former state representative, but I'm Olivia was one of my districts, and I won't take 6 minutes. I'll take a minute or two. Certainly, I support this because I wrote the bill. I want to just add a little 2 pieces of framework to this, to the members. Number one, I went to the court hearing. They were able to prosecute 6 of them. That's correct? Prosecute 6, but they allowed victim testimony from all of the women who were affected by this that chose to. Some of them had an advocate, but they all spoke. And for people that have been around me here, they know that criminal sexual assault is not only close to my family, but it's been something that I've worked on. And to hear their testimonies and to hear just how deep, just to give an example, there's a couple of the testimonies there that they only take showers in the dark now in their own home. And they didn't even have their voice in court. So I think this is a way that we can address this. In a broader sense, and this is what I want to finish with, is Representative Mueller and I have worked really proud. We worked for about 4 years on criminal sexual assault law. And this typifies what the issue is. Our laws are okay, the execution doesn't always work right, and that's what we really have to update. This is one small example. I guess my advertisement would be that as you look at future criminal sexual assault law, understand that stories like this and a lot of other ones that I experienced in my district of child sexual assault, of other things where people are basically getting away with it, okay? It's a problem in our state, and I know that we are a state that really wants to address this, so I encourage your support for this bill and any future legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And thanks for coming back to join us today to see this bill through. Where are we now? I think. Oh, Representative Bowler. Member discussion. I got there. do any members have any questions or comments?
Chair Feist, I'll be very brief. Thank you, Representative Miller, for coming back and bringing this, and very impressed that you actually kept it at a minute. Thank you for that. My only question would be, Chair Moeller, under line 524, we've got the language for two or more violations. I don't know if you'd entertain the thought of changing that or amending that if it goes through. I don't know why we don't upgrade the penalty at one. With that, I am urging my members to vote yes on this.
Chair Mueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and Lead Novotny. So this is really just closing those loopholes at this point. We didn't discuss any increase in penalties right now because we wanted to make sure that we disclose those loopholes or close those loopholes. But if you wanted to discuss additional penalties perhaps in a different bill, I'd be glad to do that.
Any closing comments?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just forgot to mention that we do have the support of both Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association for this bill. I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Mueller renews her motion that HF 111 be recommended and placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed or any opposed? Great, the motion prevails.
All right, thank you. And I'll just, if you want to stay there to adjourn, I'm just going to make an announcement quick from the table over here so we don't have to spend time going back and forth. Members, just want to remind you that we are having a nonpartisan with each of our caucuses, Criminal Law 101 training via Zoom tomorrow. We have different times scheduled, the DFL and the GOP. Just want to really highly encourage everybody to go there, and thanks in advance to our nonpartisan staff for putting that together. I think that information is going to be really useful to us as we move forward with this session. Also want to announce that Law School for Legislators is also going to be available on January 20th and January 27th. That's an outside event, but you should have received some information about that. I have not gone, but I plan to attend some of the sessions this year, and I'm really looking forward to it, and I know they put on a great presentation. So those were the only announcements that I had, Madam Chair, if you want to. And then I'll just say we have two bills on the agenda for next Tuesday, but if you want to go ahead and adjourn us, that's great.
Great, and with that, this meeting is adjourned.